Welcome to Talk Nation Radio. I'm Dori Smith.
A lot of this is just so resonant. I mean, I'm having trouble sort of keeping focused on the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
We'll hear more from Vietnam veteran and scholar Jerry Lemke as we continue our conversation about propaganda, myths, and war from Vietnam to Iraq and Afghanistan. Jerry Lemke is a professor of sociology at the College of the Holy Cross. He served as a chaplain's assistant during the Vietnam War. His 2010 book about actress Jane Fonda is titled Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. He explains in his preface that the book is not so much about Jane Fonda, the actress, but more about the myth, Hanoi Jane.
I realize that in this war, there are honest, deep differences in this country about whether we should have become involved. That there are differences to how the war should have been conducted.
It's helpful to compare media clips from the 1960s and 70s to try to understand the crisis we're in today, as we see more rhetoric about the Iraq and Afghan wars than news about events where U.S. forces have been killing and dying for almost a decade.
But the decision I announced tonight transcends those differences, for the lives of American men are involved. The opportunity for 150,000 Americans to come home in the next 12 months is involved. The future of 18 million people in South Vietnam and 7 million people in Cambodia is involved. The possibility of winning a just peace in Vietnam and in the Pacific is at stake.
I didn't cry for the Vietnamese, I cried for the Americans. Because although the bombs are falling on Vietnam, it's an American tragedy. The tragedy is ours, and it's going to take the American people many, many years to undo the damage and to wipe off the blight that has been put on our flag and our country by the likes of Mr. Nixon.
Jane Fonda visited Vietnam in 1972 as one of hundreds of peace activists. They were citizen diplomats trying to reach out to the enemy and also send a message to both the American people and U.S. forces that the war was wrong. Like others before her, including Pete Seeger and Noam Chomsky, Jane Fonda made an appeal for peace on Radio Hanoi. She accused the Nixon administration of lying to the troops and to Americans. She told U.S. pilots, quote, "If they told you the truth, you wouldn't fight, you wouldn't kill." She would later be accused of demoralizing the troops with those messages. Yet during his research for the book, Jerry Lemke had trouble finding U.S. veterans who had even heard her. It was, in fact, the hard right wing, including the John Birch Society and even members of the Ku Klux Klan, who went after Jane Fonda at home, calling her Hanoi Jane, making all sorts of charges that she was a traitor. In the FBI file about Jane Fonda that Jerry Lemke would find years later, there was an undated page stating that Jane Fonda, quote, denied being a communist. A memo from 1972 classified her as, quote, not dangerous. At the time, Americans were struggling to cope with the heavy cost of the war, confidence in the Nixon administration was shaky, and there were regular news reports showing devastating consequences from U.S. carpet bombing on Vietnamese civilians. The Hanoi Jane myth was folded into Hollywood's portrayal of soldiers who were both physically and psychologically broken by the war. The crisis in confidence that was really caused by the fact that the U.S. military lost Saigon was covered up in a smokescreen of excuses that involved U.S. peace activists, the left, the so-called doves, like Jane Fonda, who were supposedly causing the losses. And because of her tremendous beauty, Jane Fonda was also accused of a kind of castration of U.S. soldiers. In truth, it was government, military, and Hollywood making soldiers more or less invisible, replacing them with a kind of macho mythology that helped to disguise America's failed policies and hide those who were responsible for them.
I mean, the Vietnam War films, the post-Vietnam War films, were just devastating for American political culture and for images of American men. And I watched about 100 films for the film chapter in my book, The Spitting Image, and there was almost not a healthy Vietnam veteran presented in those films, and almost no political veterans presented in those films. Everybody came home from Vietnam screwed up, if you look at Hollywood films, and a lot of that damage is sexual damage. They come home as sexually inadequate in some ways. They come home twisting together of violence and sexuality. The film that had the character Travis Bickle in it was, you know, a really good example of that. And there were just lots of that from the Vietnam War years. I think that's somewhat muted now with the films of veterans of the current wars. It's still a very powerful theme in American film culture and American political culture.
And you talk about this media frenzy that was going on over POWs that were released from prison in Vietnam. And, of course, that became a huge theme of some of the anger toward, quote-unquote, Hanoi Jane Fonda. But just about what the soldiers were really experiencing, as the media was portraying these heroic people and finding better and better ways to cover their homecoming and a great big hoopla.
Yep.
Meanwhile, behind the scenes, the soldiers are writing to Newsweek magazine.
Yep.
You know, well, what about our welcome home? I mean, just by the media here,
right.
not by anyone who was against the war, but by Newsweek and by other media outlets, and saying basically, look, I lost my arms.
Yes.
Or, you know, I lost everything in this war that I fought, even I didn't want to, but I did. And here, look, you're just ignoring me.
Yeah. It was a real eye-opener for me to work on this book in a lot of ways. Almost every chapter in this book has stuff in it that I didn't know before I started working on this book. And the POW stuff is right at the top of the list of that. The fact that a lot of GIs, a lot of draftees, lower-ranking soldiers who had come home from Vietnam before the prisoners were released in the spring of 1973 were just really offended by the hoopla, as you put it, for the returning POWs, because most of these guys coming back in the spring of 72-73 were officers, they were older, and as at least one of these guys wrote to Time or Newsweek, you know, saying, these guys sat out the war in prison, okay, but I sat out the war in a bunker in South Vietnam, and so where's the difference here? What should we talk about with this? And I think, you know, this thing about no parades, that became a kind of cultural trope, too, during the 1980s, that Vietnam veterans didn't get their parade when they came home, and so there's resentment about that, and a lot of Vietnam veterans were saying that. Now, early on, I said, you know, wait a minute, when we came home from Vietnam, we didn't want a parade. Most of us wanted to join the anti-war movement, and the rest of us just wanted to get on with our lives. People didn't come home from Vietnam expecting a parade or wanting a parade. But that story gets revised by the 1980s. And by the 1980s, a lot of Vietnam veterans are complaining. So I have thought for a long time, where did this come from, right? How did this begin to get revised and retold over the years? Now I think that the repatriation of the POWs in 1973 has a lot to do with this. I think that that was the spark that set off a lot of this resentment. And from 1973 on, then, it continued to grow. And there was enough kind of right-wing political sentiment in the culture that said our Vietnam veterans didn't get what they deserved because the anti-war movement hated them and the whole country had turned against the war and against the people who fought the war. And so they began to chime in on this no parades thing, or they were saying it, and some Vietnam veterans began to chime in on that. And how the POWs were treated, I think I came away from writing this chapter thinking, I don't think we really know now a whole bunch about that. We have the accounts in that are written by the POWs themselves, some of the POWs in their memoirs. I read 30-some of those for writing that chapter. Virtually all of those that had been published by the time that this phrase, Hanoi Jane, was very much in play. And the reason I did that is because so many commentators today say, well, it was the POWs who hate Jane Fonda, and they are the ones who dubbed her Hanoi Jane. So I went and looked at the memoirs to see if that was true. It's not true. Out of 30-some memoirs, the first 30-some that were written well into the 1980s, only three of those mentioned Jane Fonda at all. One of those mentions was a positive mention of her. So now we're down to two mentions, and only one of those used the term Hanoi Jane. But again, that was late. That phrase was already very much in play. So my point there is that it wasn't POWs who began to vilify Hanoi Jane. It can't be laid at their feet, or much less so at Vietnam veterans in general.
I think, too, we have to remember that this war dragged on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see anti-war sentiment growing everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
At the Sentinel, you know, all the training facilities, all the branches, there
sure.
were angry people who did not want to go.
Right.
I want to turn to page 138, where you talk about someone that I was privileged to have met, William Sloan Coffin, and how he's trying to make a public statement, anti-war.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, of course, the Reverend Coffin from New Haven. Now, as he did that, someone was almost able to assault him. And he went through a lot of that. And
yes.
I want to talk about that in this context, because part of the charges were, you know, because of you, the POWs are not coming home, or you're against having the POWs saved. You know, it kind of got, again, displaced anger. Really, what was keeping the POWs in prison was the war.
Absolutely. And just on that point, briefly, I think now it's pretty widely understood by historians that the Nixon administration manipulated the POW issue because lots of Americans stayed in support of the war until the POWs came home. And Nixon wanted to keep the war going. By that time, it was the government in South Vietnam that was mainly kind of our proxy fighting the war, but Nixon was using the POWs themselves as sort of a pawn in order to keep the American people behind what he wanted to do in Vietnam. And when the final settlement came about, the POWs did come home without us actually winning the war. And so people who supported the war then would accuse the anti-war movement of wanting to abandon the POWs, and, you know, end the war, bring the troops home, but leave the POWs behind. So, that was very emotionally powerful rhetoric, and that's what emerged in Waterbury, Connecticut, when Jane Fonda and Robert De Niro went there in 1988 to film what became Stanley and Iris, and they wanted to use Waterbury because it was an old industrial town, and this was a factory worker-based story. There was a group of conservative VFW members, Vietnam veterans, in Waterbury who opposed the use of Waterbury to make that film because they opposed Jane Fonda. And their main line was that Jane Fonda had betrayed the POWs and she had called the POWs hypocrites and liars, which she did because she thought that their claims of having been tortured in Hanoi were not true. I think, like she does today, that was a poor choice of words. But, you know, how the POWs were actually treated, I'm not sure that she was wrong either. I think that we really don't know a lot about that. That was the context in which William Sloan Coffin came to Waterbury to give a talk himself, and he met a lot of opposition. Actually, he had probably come before that time, but it was this VFW chapter that opposed him. He said Waterbury was the worst experience that he ever had. He never wanted to go back to Waterbury. The film did get made, Stanley and Iris. But Fonda's time there was really a pretty raucous time. And that's when this phrase, Hanoi Jane, really got into the American public lexicon, because the opposition to her was picked up by mainstream media. The major networks picked it up and kind of plastered it all over America. And so that's when the phrase, it wasn't really invented in Waterbury. It had been around before then, but that really made it a popular phrase.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. I'm Dori Smith. You can hear more of this interview with Jerry Lemke at talknationradio.org.
If there's anything I learned in Vietnam, it's after 4,000 years of struggle against nature and against all kinds of very powerful and professional armies, they will not surrender now. They never have in their past, and they are certainly not going to surrender now. And Richard Nixon's 8-point plan of May 8th is asking the peasants and the people who are on the verge of controlling their own lives for the first time in so long to lay down their arms and compromise, and I do not believe they will do it. And I think that Richard Nixon is going to have to study Vietnamese history, read Vietnamese poetry. many, many people in America who are speaking out against the crimes that are being committed in our name by Nixon and by the Pentagon. The people who are struggling to reestablish in America the qualities that we started out with. It is these people who are the real patriots.
What's that sound? Everybody look, what's going down? Stop. What's that sound? Everybody look, what's going down? Stop. What's that sound? Everybody look.
We could get some sense of what this was like by looking at what happened to the Dixie Chicks for a time, or some of what we saw with some of the people who were in the custody of the Iraqis, too. And that, I think, is a fascinating analogy. I do want to talk about what else you learned about the stories themselves, about these POWs. In many cases, they were either exaggerations or direct lies. And I want to talk about how they made it into the mainstream, because you did find connections to very powerful figures like Ayn Rand, or like you were talking about the John Birch Society.
Yeah.
I think the politics are very much part of today's world.
The definitive book on this POW stuff, well, the best book right now is a book by Craig Howes, The POW Experience or something like that. That's the very best book that there is. But the question you're asking is how this story gets retold then. Because, as you pointed out, when the POWs came home in 1973, as I go back and read it now, and I did for this book, Time Magazine, Newsweek Magazine, the newspapers, I think the bulk of the coverage kind of dismissed this idea that they had been treated badly. I mean, their initial medical appointments found them to be in quite good health, and subsequent, you know, medical following of their health over the years concluded that the treatment of them must not have been too bad. So you go from there to, you know, where we are today, or probably sometime during the 1980s, when this begins to reverse. And that's the story that I think you're asking about. And I think that book needs to be written. Somebody needs to get into the history of representation, the imaging of the POW experience, and starting from what Craig Howes writes, and then going up to, again, Hollywood probably plays a huge role. I mean, the Rambo films that came out in the 1980s, the POW rescue films, this idea that we left behind some POWs, and so that we need to go back and if not refight the war, continue the war in order to bring some of the POWs home. That storyline really begins to sink in the 1980s, and I think it's a way of beginning to remilitarize the country and to sort of culturally fight against what conservatives call the Vietnam syndrome, the unwillingness of the American people to go into war. And so I think the POW story, the POW narrative, plays a huge role in that. I think Hollywood plays a huge role in that. The ultra-right plays a big role in that, the John Birch Society in particular. This whole, again, back to the themes of betrayal and paranoia, all of that plays really, really large in the 1980s. The POWs, the abandoned POWs, becomes a kind of a metaphor for America abandoned by its government. And that plays really loudly, right, in the militia movements of the 1980s, sort of the conservative backlash to government, the conservative backlash to liberalism, to the anti-war movement. That really is what the Reagan Revolution and the Reagan years of the 1980s is all about. And that continues to be this idea that somebody in Washington is disloyal to the America. My goodness, we saw that just so boldly in the Rolling Stone story a couple of weeks ago, Michael Hastings' story on General McChrystal. The epigram for that, I mean, if listeners missed it, you know, look at the epigram for that Rolling Stone story, that General McChrystal took control of the war by keeping his eye on the real enemy, the wimps in the White House. That's almost verbatim quote from that epigram. The real enemy is at home. Not only at home, the real enemy is in Washington. The real enemy is in the White House. And there's a gendering of that again, right? It's the wimps. And that is why I think the Hanoi Jane imagery is so important. It's not just Jane Fonda. You could almost drop Jane Fonda out of my book. The book is not about Jane Fonda. The book is about that gendered betrayal narrative that Hanoi Jane helps construct. And I think that if we maybe kind of drifted away from that for a few years, we're back to that now, really, really big time. And these lost wars are in Afghanistan and Iraq are going to go down again as wars that were lost because of something gone wrong on the home front.
And in the future, we may see the U.S. government military industry doing more with the people that they're fighting against today than any anti-war movement ever did. Or, you know, in terms of just looking at Russia and China today, we see a lot of financial ties between America and those countries, those parts of the world that didn't exist before. But when you look at the irony there, they've been more involved with the, you know, thrust of military advance in China, Russia, the former Soviet Union, than certainly anyone who was a member of the anti-war effort. It was more military industry that won the war, ultimately, and merged these two parts of the world, right?
Oh, I think certainly that's true with the former Soviet Union and the Soviet republics. I mean, my goodness, I mean, what's going on there is just jaw-dropping almost by the day. The revelation about a month ago of mineral deposits in Afghanistan and the fact that the Chinese already have a foothold in Afghanistan, building a road into Afghanistan for the mines that they have operating there, and then the building of military bases. I mean, some of this now is not revelatory. It's not really new. It was very new, I think, to most of us in 2001 to realize that we've already got bases in places like Uzbekistan, and so that's huge. I think China is another matter. I think a lot of what's going on now in the former Soviet republics and Southwest Asia, I think a lot of it has to do with U.S. interests in China, you know, powerful U.S. business and political interests, concerns, worries about the power of China. I'm afraid that a lot of the maneuvering that's going on now in the West and the South of China really is a kind of encroachment of U.S. power on China from the South. I think that's the really, really big picture for what's going on there. Nobody's really talking about it in those terms. Nobody's writing about it. We just kind of get these glimpses, you know, when the fog parts like it did on these stories of minerals in Afghanistan. My own mind has China and Russia kind of in two different spaces on these things.
Well, I think it's fascinating to think also about the general you spoke with in Waterbury, Connecticut, Guy Russo.
Yes.
How much did he really know about the material and information he might have seen to become convinced that A, Jane Fonda was a communist, and B, she was an enemy of the United States?
Yeah.
Because when I saw, you know, in the pages after you mentioned your meeting with him and his views about what you talked about before, William Sloan Coffin's visit to Waterbury, the fervor about the actors coming to Waterbury in general. Some might see it as a financial boon. He saw it as evidence that society was at risk of turning communist and that these people were the sort of advanced team.
Yeah.
On page 138, though, you talk about what was in a dossier about Jane Fonda and also about Tom Hayden. This was evidence file for case against them.
Yeah.
And it was actually from an organization that was anti-Fonda and had a local branch involvement, if you will. And it was part of a National Security Center, the association led ultimately to the John Birch Society.
Yeah, well, those that's the thread that I was able to put my fingers on. Again, I didn't go looking for any of this because I didn't know, I had no idea that any of this was there to be looked for. And it kind of came tumbling out. I mean, first of all, I had a very nice, pleasant, civil sit-down with General Russo, who has now passed away, by the way, I'm told, and was sort of taken aback when he kept referring to her as the communist. And it was sort of had that Birch-esque ring to it, the way he was talking about this. And then to find out that he had been closely involved with a Minutemen organization at that time that was a kind of a militia, a local militia group. Now, that goes all the way back to the 1960s, by the way. That's not just the 1980s, but that goes back a long way. And the fear there locally was that the communists would, there would be an invasion, you know, from the coast. And so they were preparing to meet that. People like Jane Fonda, of course, were kind of part of the softening up brigade, you know, to render us more helpless. A lot of this is just so resonant. I mean, I'm having trouble sort of keeping focused on the 60s, 70s, and 80s because, again, you know, the Minutemen are riding the range in the western states. We're just so much back to this now, the sort of invasion and this stuff. It goes away for a while and then it comes back. But one of the veterans in Waterbury had this file. They'd collected all this stuff. It was very generous in lending it to me, by the way. And it was a kind of faux dossier on Jane Fonda and Tom Hayden, making a case that they should be indicted for treason. That was the material that was in that, and it came from some national, you might have it in front of you, security group that I'd never heard of. And so I hastened to find out what I could about them and what their contacts were, who they were tied to, and it was the John Birch Society. Which, finding that, is kind of a aha moment, not a big surprise, but to be able to document it, I thought was quite good, I hope quite useful. There are, of course, people like Chip Berle at Political Research Associates in Boston who do this kind of research on a regular basis. I mean, what I did there and write about in just a few paragraphs, that took me a lot of time to do that, and trips to Waterbury to do that. There are people like Chip Berle who do this on a regular basis and continue, because these organizations come and go. They dissolve and then they reform again under new names. I haven't kept up with these particular ones since I wrote that material 5 or 6 years ago, actually. So again, you might have listeners who want to pick up on some of that and see where the epilogue of the Waterbury story is today. You know, where does it go? Does it have a new life? And if so, what's it called and what's it doing?
Jerry Lemke, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, this has been good. Thanks for having me on your show.
Vietnam veteran Jerry Lemke. He's a professor of sociology at the College of the Holy Cross. His newly released book about actress Jane Fonda and much more is titled Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. We'll link to it on our website, Talk Nation Radio. Jerry Lemke's previous book was The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated nationally with Pacifica Network. You can find audio at talknationradio.org, and you can write to us at talknationradio@gmail.com. Our music is by Fritz Heed. Underwriting for our show was brought to you by JeremyRHammond.com, political analysis from outside the standard framework. He's founder and editor of ForeignPolicyJournal.com and a recipient of the Project Censored 2010 Award. At JeremyRHammond.com, you can read his story, Turning Back from the Point of No Return, Implications of the Threat to Bomb Iran.